I'm John, I'm a drug addict. Holy shit, there's a lot of y'all, man. Anybody else nervous, or is it just me? Somebody probably is out there, because I can tell you, man, when I got sober, man, I couldn't talk for the first 3 months, man. That bedevilment thing was just kicking my ass, man. I was so nervous and had so much anxiety, and I still do to some degree. You know, it's gotten a little bit better. And yeah, my sponsor, one of the first things I remember my sponsor telling me when I was, he came out, actually not here, there was another place, there was a house on Slaughter that was part of Austin Recovery where I sobered up back in 2011 at, and I remember coming out there and he told me that, you know, if he could give me the gift of sobriety, he wouldn't do it because it would rob me of the journey. And it's been quite an amazing journey, you know. And when I committed to speak here, you know, I was scrolling through Facebook, something I do entirely too much of, and I saw Chris put a post on Facebook, you know, and it said that he was looking for speakers out here, and you know, and I just kind of zoomed through it, and I was like, you know, I should volunteer to do that, you know. And then I went ahead and passed it up, and then I went back again, and I was like, no, and yes, and no, and yes, and you know, and then I finally said, you know, hey, I'm an alumni, I'll do it, you know. And then I sat and I hoped. I was like, well, fuck, I hope he doesn't respond, you know. And then 5 minutes later, I got a message, you know, how about this date, you know. So then I was stuck into it. So I thought of all kinds of excuses, you know, how can I get out of this with some practicing and some integrity. And I'm glad to be here, though, man, because I got a lot of history in this at this facility. I was talking to Chris before this meeting. I came through here my first time in 1987, I think it was, you know, and this place was quite a bit different back then. You know, it was a row of kind of shacks out there. You know, it was a volleyball court and a kitchen that I think burned down, and, you know, it wasn't a lot of treatment stuff. You know, it was all about the 12 steps, you know. And I still believe that today, that it's all about the 12 steps, because every treatment center that I've been into and I've walked out the door, they've all told me the same thing. You know, get a sponsor, get a home group, go to meetings, work the steps. You know, and that's just been my story, you know. And I've learned to just try to keep it really, really simple. And so I don't have a full hour. I think I got 40 minutes or something. So I'm just going to kind of qualify, you know, myself and not go back too far. But, you know, I can tell you that, you know, from as long as I can remember, and I'm from Austin, or I got here in the 70s, and I grew up out in Kyle. We had a 112-acre dairy farm that I grew up on as a kid. And we moved here in the 70s. And just for as long as I can remember, I always felt a little bit different. So I always felt a little bit different, you know, and always kind of wanted to be accepted, you know, amongst the people I was around, you know. And that played a big part, you know, of if I could just be like him, you know, or if I could just have that, you know, or those clothes, or as a kid, if I could have his skateboard or his bicycle, you know, everything would be, you know, so much better. And so I always kind of felt like that, you know, just always felt different. You know, later on, flash forward, you know, I understand that that's part of my alcoholism, you know, always wanting to be somebody else or something different to make myself, you know, I'll feel better, you know, if I can just get this or be that person or this job. And I chased that for a really long time. And so I, at a really young age, you know, I had parents that were kind of, you know, they were, my dad was kind of a hippie, you know, and my mom to this day still rides a Harley, and, you know, there was a lot of pot, you know, and music and stuff going on, and you know, and all of my people I looked up to, you know, smoked dope, you know, and so I wanted to smoke dope, you know, and if I saw them sneaking into the bathroom doing cocaine, I wanted to go do some cocaine, you know, because I wanted to be like them, you know, I wanted to be accepted, and, so followed that through, and by the time I was, I guess I was 15. I'm skipping over a lot of stuff. By the time I was 15, you know, I found IV drugs. You know, at 15 years old, and it started off with cocaine, and then it progressed into meth, and you know, I just kept just at that point I was burglarizing stuff and stealing every possible thing I could steal, you know, and I left home at, I think, 15 years old and ran off, you know, and was kind of on the streets and just a street kid, you know. Back then we moved into Austin. You know, it was quite a bit different back then. You know, this was before pre-gangs and all of that stuff. And we moved over off of Runberg and 35 area. You know, it was quite a bit different back then, but I went to Dobie and it's still a little kind of a roughneck area, you know, kind of some rough kids, you know, we broke into cars and did all that kind of stuff. And, we're just kind of little thugs. And, so we, you know, I lived there for a little while and we constantly moved. We did a lot of moving. And, so my mom got a different job and we moved a little further into Austin, into, the Crestview area. And I went to, Lamar, where I met a whole new kind of clique of people. I went to Lamar Junior High and ended up going to McCallum, and then a school that was a secondary school called W.R. Robbins. And so I went to Robbins, and I kind of found all the kids that were just the misfit kids, you know, the artists and the punk rockers and the skaters, and those are the kids that I kind of hung out with, you know, and it just took me on this whole new cycle. And you know, at that time I really wasn't I wasn't full on, you know, I mean, I experimented with kind of shooting some dope here and there, you know, and it rapidly progressed, and I ended up dropping out of school, and I picked up a few felonies along the way. And so by the time I was, I guess I was 18 years old, at that point it had gotten pretty bad. You know, I tried heroin for the first time, and it took me to some pretty dark places, you know, and I constantly, you know, every so often I would try to, you know, think, if I could just quit, man, if I could if I could just stop shooting dope, like everything will be okay, you know, I'll get the job. And I tried all kinds of, I mean, every possible thing I could think to try, you know, I ran across the country, and it's like, well, I'll go to Key West, you know, because they don't do that down there, you know. And of course, then I found myself, which they did. I couldn't find it there, but Miami was, you know, so it just made it a lot further to drive to go cop, you know, having to drive from Key West to Miami. So I tried that, and, you know, and then I decided, well, I'll go to San Francisco, you know, and that took me about 6 years to get out of that city of being a street junkie in San Francisco, and a lot of crazy shit happened there, you know. And I recently took my wife out there on a trip, and that city's changed quite a bit, but they recently decriminalized a usable amount, you know, so it's just gotten just crazy. I mean, these kids are in the streets, you know. I mean, we saw a girl that was pregnant, looked like she was probably 17 years old, you know, just downtown, you know, on Market Street, sitting in a little, you know, in front of a storefront, you know, and just shooting dope, you know, right there in the streets. And I couldn't help but just think, God, man, thank you, God, you know, for whatever reason, you know, I don't know why, there's a lot of people that just never get this thing, they just never get it, you know, and for whatever reason, it's just my take on it, God chose me, you know, chose me to get this thing, you know, and it took a lot of beatings, you know, a lot of just ass kickings to get it, you know. So, so flash forward, you know, I ran all over the place, Portland, Denver, San Francisco, Key West. I lived in Houston, and one point, and I'm just going to tell a couple of their stories just to kind of classify that were pretty profound experiences. I was 18, and I came through Austin Recovery. It was called REAP back then, and I got sent to a place called the Stratford House, which was over off of MLK. You went to the detox that was over there, and you went to the Stratford House. And I got my first 12-hour pass, and I was with another guy. He had a 36-hour pass, and back then they didn't test for benzodiazepines. You know, they had to send it off to wherever to get tested for it. So we had this bright idea that we're gonna take off. I got 12 hours. I can make it to Mexico in 12 hours, and I can pick up these. I can get these benzos, you know, and they can't test for them. So the whole Stratford House is waiting for us to get back, and so. We get there, we end up pounding down some margaritas and swallowing pills, and so on the way back, and you can't even make this shit up, you know, it's crazy, man. But so we're on our way back, and we have a blowout in this guy's truck, and I think we're like around San Marcos or something somewhere, and so we get out, and we're trying to change the tire, and he blames me, I blame him. Somebody didn't tighten the lugs on to the tire on the truck, you know, so get up to about 65, the wheel flies off of the truck, and sets the whole median on fire, right? So, like, there's flames, I guess, the sparks. So people are pulling over with fire extinguishers, just spraying the median up and trying to get the fire out. And I'm like, fuck, man, I'm on felony probation, man. If I don't get back, you know, like, I'm going to penitentiary. You know, and I'm looking at my watch, you know, and I'm like, well, dude, you got 36 hours. I got to go. You're staying with your truck. So I start hitchhiking, and this hippie picks me up and gives me a ride to, I don't know where, Kyle or something, and I keep hitchhiking, and these three girls pull over and pick me up, and I remember, and I remember looking up at their steering wheel, and they used to have these, I don't think they still make them, but they had these reflector stickers that said like one day at a time, and just for today, they were AA stickers they used to have, and they had one of those on the thing and on their steering wheel, so they gave me a ride to the front door of the Stratford House, and I made it just in time, man. And so all the people, they're all waiting, you know, all the clients in there, because probably 90% of them had no desire to get clean, you know, kind of the way it is now. You know, most people come to treatment, their parents pay for it, and they just want their cars back, and they go back out and use. Unfortunately, that's kind of the truth of it, you know. So I got back, and that night we had an outside. We were allowed to go to an outside meeting, and I was 18 years old, and so our outside meeting. At this point, you know, we'd swallowed handfuls of pills, and we wound up. There used to be a strip club called the Red Rose on Ben White, and so we wound up in this strip club, and this kid had like this really badass 1970 something Z28 with the big wheels on the back, all souped up, and we pull out of the Red Rose, and I just remember kind of in and out of a blackout, just bam, and we just nailed the car. I mean, just knocked the shit out of it right at Ben White, right in front of the Red Rose. And I'm in and out of this blackout, and I remember looking over at him going, the guy's already out of the car, and he's over at our car, and he's screaming at us, and he's in a wheelchair, right? This guy had I guess he had to get his chair out, and he came up, and we'd been there for however long, you know, and so he it was fucked up, man. So he's screaming at us, and I said, dude, just go, you know. When he does, we just go, and this guy was kind of like this on the car. So it knocked him out of his chair, and all I remember is waking up and hitting two cop cars. And I woke up in jail, and I have a friend of mine that says he went through Stratford House years later, and he says, you know, this is closed now, but he's like, they still use that story, you know, what not to do. Don't do that, you know. And so I woke up in jail, and I was like, fuck, I'm on felony probation. This shit's going down. I got a wheelchair, you know, and I hit and run, and cops, and I was stuffing bottles of Rohypnols or Valiums or whatever the fuck I had down my pants. And like the next day they called me, and they were like, French, ATW, the fuck, how did that happen, you know? So I get out, and I go call the probation officer, because I have an in-house probation officer there, and I'm coming up with some extravagant lie, you know, some bullshit. And he goes, the only reason you're out is because I got him to let you out, you know. And I got out, and they tacked on a year to my probation. You know, somehow I skated through that shit, you know, so some bad shit happened. And so I continued to use, you know. I think the normal person would probably go, you know, probably, you know, a good time to, you know, consider that, you know, that's not, you know. You know, you might be a drug addict. Not because all that shit, you know. All that shit just makes me a criminal if I'm hitting and running and doing all that shit, you know. So this just kind of continued. This shit continued. I wound up in Houston, Texas, and this was another pretty that was a pretty traumatic event. And in between, there was all kinds of shit. Burglaries and jails and overdoses and all kinds of shit. And so another pretty profound one, because not only did I like to shoot heroin, you know, if I had a few extra dollars, I like to smoke some crack too, you know. And Houston is a great place, you know, for, you know, everyone smoke crack, you know. So I was in Houston and I was smoking crack and eating Rohypnols, you know, great combination. And I come up with this bright idea that I've got $3 to my name and I'm going to go rob these dope dealers, you know, with my $3. So I'm in Houston and I go to turn around to leave. You know, I'm in the Montrose, and this guy's got this apartment that's kind of sunken down. Well, not Montrose, actually by the Galleria. And I turned around. I went to go leave, and I hit the sliding glass door with my forehead, and I shattered the whole fucking door. And I kept going. And I was like, I kept going. You know, I didn't even really, you know, I was just so out of it. And I took this guy's, I was in a little, I didn't even have a car. I was in just, took this guy's, I think I might even stole his keys. And it was a Geo Metro, like this little piece of shit, you know, clothes piled up, you know. And so I go down to this neighborhood, and I want to say it was like Sharkstown or some Greens Point or some fucking hellhole. And I give the guy, you know, the $3 or whatever, and I hit the gas pedal. And I hit his hand, and the rocks flew off the car. And I remember hearing two gunshots, and I felt, I was like, what the fuck? And then there was just blood everywhere, and I got shot in the head, and thank God it was, you know, something like maybe a 25 or something, you know, it wasn't a bigger caliber gun. And I remember my friends taking me to Bentob Hospital, and I'm in there, and all I can think about the whole time is, fuck, they're out there smoking all my fucking crack. Yeah. Out of here, you know? I just got shot, you know? And I mean, it's funny, but it's true, you know? Because I'm that guy, you know? I mean, I could be, if I'm, if I'm doing this, man, you beat the shit out of me, and I want to get my, you know, I'm that guy, you know. I mean, I'm going, you know. And then the following day, you know, after getting out, the bullet entered, exited, you know, and the cops came with the homicide, whatever, and mailed the letter to my grandmother's house, who freaked out about homicide, mailing letters here. And, you know, the next day I was down the north side and I was copping heroin, you know, in the hood in Houston. So none of that shit really, you know. So that's the kind of shit that went on, you know, just fucking complete chaos, man. You know, whatever. It was just, I mean, I was just one tracked, you know. It was like, well, at all costs, you know. And So anyway, that kind of stuff just went on, and, you know, I made several trips. I didn't do a lot of trips. I have a friend that says, I went through 8 treatment centers, and I didn't do a lot of treatment centers, but I did a shit ton of detoxes, because I can tell you, usually about after 3 days, man, I'm good, man. You know, I'm good. You know, I don't need shit. I'm good, you know. And then I get out, and I can tell you, you know, sitting in here thinking about getting loaded beats the fuck out of being out there thinking about getting clean. I can tell you from my experience, you know. And I would be out there, and I'd get in and, you know, just begging to get into detox. And it's not easy these days. I'm sure you most know, it's not easy to get into treatment or detox these days. And I'd get in and, you know, begging to get in. And then as soon as I get in, you know, it's like, the nurse is a bitch, the food tastes like shit, the bed's uncomfortable, you know, I'm ungrateful, you know, and then I'm back out there again, and I was stuck in that cycle, man, just fucking in and out, you know. And just to show you, the first time was 87, you know, and I went through, you know, there's treatment centers that I don't even remember. Somebody said something on Facebook that's in recovery now a couple weeks ago, and he goes, said something about, can you pay me back for all those cigarettes you got for me at Riverside Hospital? And, you know, I don't even remember going through that hospital in Houston, you know, but I went through a detox there, you know, I guess, you know. So I went through a whole bunch of them, man, from San Francisco to wherever, you know. So anyway, shit just progressively just, you know, it just got worse. You know, I thought I was going to be a drug dealer at one point and fly a lot of LSD back and forth from San Francisco, and that ended with, you know, spending it all on dope and overdoses and, you know, that kind of shit. And So I think that somewhat qualifies, you know. I think I qualify that I'm a drug addict, man. Once I start, there ain't no stopping, you know. Nothing is going to, you know, I am one tracked, you know. And I can't stop, you know. I just can't stop once I get started. And eventually, you know, when it came close to getting to an end, I was living with a friend of mine he's dead now. He was a heroin addict, very talented guitar player, and I grew up with, went to school with, he'd ask you, he'd tell you he was clean because he stopped shooting heroin, but then he drank himself to death, you know. And he was kind of the last place that I was at that I was staying with over on the northeast side in Austin, at that point it was pitiful, man. There was nothing, and I know, you know, heroin acts we think we're so much cooler than everybody, you know, and all that good shit, but there was nothing charming or glamorous about any of it. It had gotten down to where, man, I was hustling for, you know, a half a bag of dope or a bag of dope, and it was pitiful. And the place I was staying with my friend Jake was over on the northeast side, and it was a house that was for people that were on disability checks, you know. It's like 4 or 5 rooms, and no food, you know. And it was the floor you walked in, because, you know, he quit doing the dope and he got on Suboxone and was drinking himself to death, you know. So you walked in and there was just steel reserve cans all over the floor, Suboxone wrappers all over the floor, you know, just covered, a horrible smell, and something that was making noise in the bedroom, which turned out to be a turkey leg under the bed that a rat was eating. You know, so it was nasty. It was bad. And he had there was no cable in there, and he had a VCR that had he had 2 tapes for this VCR, and one was that movie Big, you know, Tom Hanks, Big. And so there's no cable, so it was like, and then another one was like some Dallas Cowboy training thing, you know, from 1985, you know, or something. And so it was like Big on constant, you know, just rotation, you know, just for something to stare at. And it was really depressing. I mean, picture that, you know. I mean, that's depressing, man. It was depressing. And so on one of my trips to, I went through another little detox thing in, where was it, Waco or somewhere, and I met a girl. And I ended up running with this girl for, I guess, probably about 3 years, man. And And so when it came time that it just got really bad for me, man, and I finally got to that place that the books talks about, the jumping off point, man. I was finally just at that place, man. I was so beat up, man, and I just give up, man. I just finally had gotten to that place that, I say it was just defeat. You know, I don't even know about surrender. I just know I was defeated, man. I was just completely defeated. You know, I was defeated, and I'd had enough, you know. And that's just what it took for me, man. I had to get to that place to where I was just completely, completely beat up. And this, I brought this just to read, because this like sums it up, and I love this out of this. This is out of the 12 and 12, and it's the last paragraph of step one. And it says, under the lash of alcoholism, we are driven to A. There we discover the fatal nature of our situation, that I was a stone cold, I was a junkie, you know. Then and only then do we become as open-minded to conviction and willing to listen as the dying can be. We stand ready to do anything which will lift this merciless obsession. That's kind of where I was at, you know, at that point, man. I was willing to do whatever it took, man. And so I remember I was standing on the northeast side, and my friend Jake was hanging out, drinking at the corner on North Loop. That's where they all hung out and did their drinking thing. And the girl at that point was about to run off, because she was hustling the dope dealer, you know. And so she was about to run off with him. And I told her, I said, if you leave with him, I'm done. You know, I'm done with you, you know. And, of course, that didn't faze her, you know. And so when that didn't work, you know, I was trying to manage that whole situation, you know, like the book talks about, you know, which never works. And so I was talking to my friend, and I came up with this idea. I was like, all right, man, I'm going to rob this guy. You know, he's old. You know, he's 70-year-old dope dealer. I'm just going to yank him out of his car and rob him, you know. And thank God, my friend kind of said that's probably a really bad idea, because he was tied in with some pretty – he'd have some little youngsters after me that probably come looking. And I was a 120-pound junkie, you know. He gave me his keys and my friend, and he had like 65 cents or something, you know, which is a pretty big deal, you know, for a raging alcoholic, you know, who's hustling for a beer, you know. And he gave me his 65 cents, man. And I was driving an old beat up Toyota 4Runner the girl I was dating had I'd never heard of them, man, but they, oh, somacomas. I never even seen no shit. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of that stuff, but she had a somacoma driving down I-35 where they just, like, lights are on and nobody's there. You know, I'm like, you know, and so we crashed the car. And so I'm driving this old beat-up 4Runner. And at that point, it was like, that's when I was out of options. And believe me, I sat there for, like, probably a good 30 minutes going, okay, rob the dope dealer, go back to Jake's house with the rat and the turkey leg and Big on the VCR. Or go to the NA24, you know, and it just, you know, I mean, it just didn't sound all that bad to go to NA24 at that point, and they had a bed, and so I went to the North Austin 24-Hour Club, and they had a bed, and I stayed there for 30 days, man, and I had a pitiful little heroin habit, and I cheated while I was there, you know, because I was willing to go to any length to get sober or clean, even if it meant lie, steal, cheat, whatever it fucking meant to get clean, I was willing to do it. And I had a sponsor that he's like, all right, man, the girl I've been dating had a script for Suboxones in the pharmacy. He's like, I'll buy you four of them. So I snuck them in, and I ended up taking, you know, a few Suboxones to get me through, because I would have left, you know, most likely I would have left. You know, I was dope sick. And so stayed there for 30 days. And the whole time I'm trying to manage her into recovery, you know, like, because she needs to get this shit too, you know. So I was kind of like, it talks about in the big book, and where it's 60 through 63, the third step, you know, the actor that can be quite, you know, virtuous, you know, he can be really nice, great guy, you know. And so I tried that route, like, I'll make sure if you just go into treatment, you know, you got a pillow, cigarettes, money, you'll have everything, you know. And of course it didn't work. So then I went the other route, you know, if you don't go, you know, all this bad shit's gonna happen, I'm gonna do this and this and that, and that didn't work. And so I wound up coming out here to AR, which was a humbling experience, because I worked here in 2005 for a couple years, and as a dry drug addict, and I don't suggest that at all, because talk about misery and uncomfortableness, man. Fuck, man, because sobriety is my problem, you know, and my solution to sobriety is the dope, you know, and the alcohol. Now it's the steps and the work, you know. So I ended up coming out here as a client to the other house they had on Slaughter Lane, and I stayed there for 60 days, and I got out, and the whole time I was in there, you know, they had little study halls and stuff you had to go to, and I knew this time I was like, I was so beat up that I didn't do exactly what they told me to in, you know, in AR when I was there. But when I was in the study hall, supposed to be working on my life story and stuff, I was in there writing a four step. That's just me. Cause I was like, man, I am working the steps, man, because I've had enough, man. You know, so I did a four step, and my sponsor was one of those guys. He had me do my fifth step with him and three other people. And I was just willing, you know, it's like, okay, where are they at? What's next, man? I was just beaten into that place. And so I got out and, called the girl and, called the sober house I was going into and said, hey, I'm getting out. You want to meet, you know, and hang out for a little bit. And so I called him and told him to be a day late. And I went and rented a room and slept with her. And 9 months later, I had a baby, you know, and who was in NICU for a month. And so if you do that math, you know, 30 days at the 24-hour club, 30 days at AR, 9 months later, a baby, and you add on another month for the NICU, the time he was kicking Suboxone, it's right at a year, you know, so my 1 year of sobriety, almost to the day I brought a newborn baby home as a single father, and about the journey, and there was a lot of fears, man, behind that, you know, I'd go up there and I'd see him, and I walked through a lot watching her, you know, she'd come up there high, you know, and I'm watching my little son, you know, eyes watering, you know, going through all the detox and stuff, and her coming up there doing all this crap, you know, and I just had to go, you know, man, by the grace of God, there go I, you know, that's me, you know, I couldn't have done, you know, she's probably doing the best that she can do, you know, and so I brought this baby home, and so there was a lot of fear behind that shit, you know, because it's like, man, I started off doing day labor, you know, I don't even know, how am I going to take care of a baby, you know, so I brought this baby home, and thank God my mom's in Georgetown and she helped quite a bit, you know. And so I got a job in a treatment center as a recovery advocate, a recovery coach for Eudaimonia. A $12 an hour job, I think it was, 13, I don't know, something, $12, $13 an hour. And it was rough, man. It was a struggle, you know. Man, I mean, daycares are like, shit, make $1,000 a month or something, you know. And I got this newborn, and I took this baby with me everywhere I went. I kind of became known as that guy, you know. I mean, everywhere I'd go to Northland a lot because there's all those old women there, you know. And they would always take the baby, you know. And I was the, like, tattooed heroin addict with the baby, you know. And it inspired me to go to a lot more meetings, too, because I was like, I got to get away from this fucking kid, man, you know. And I'd have to... You know, I didn't have a clue what I was doing. I can't tell you how many times, man, I drove home, and I'm like, or I'll be leaving, and I'm like, oh, the diaper bag, you know, and I'm taking my shirt off, you know, to put a, you know, tie on, you know. And I was completely clueless, and somebody said, dude, just feed them. Just feed them and learn to say no a whole bunch, you know, but there is a lot more than that. But I did, you know, I just fed him and I learned to say no a whole bunch. And there was a lot of, thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. And wherever you get it, I just happened to find my solution in AA. And I love to be able to come in here and talk about the dope and that, because that's part of my story. I was taught that, you know, when I'm in AA, to respect the house that I'm in and not classify as an alcoholic when I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just happens to be where I walked into, you know. So wherever, you know, AA, NA, CA, you know, it's all the same principles, you know, the same steps. I just found it there. And so I brought this baby and took him with me everywhere, you know, and I was just like, Barry, it was just me and him, you know. And so sobered up at the kind of the 24-hour club, and because that place saved my life, man. You know, there wasn't any other club that had a bed for me, and they did, and they took me in. So I'd always kind of my sponsor was from Northland, and so I'd do Northland quite a bit for some solution. There was a lot of sobriety in there, and then I'd go over to NA24 because, you know, they told me there is no higher purpose than helping another alcoholic. You know, that's it. You know, that nothing will ensure my sobriety more than intensive work with other alcoholics. And so I still, to this day, you know, I go to the NA24, you know, and try to carry the message there. You know, I hear a lot of people that, you know, a lot of these guys at some of these other meetings are like, well, there's not a lot of solution there. Well, take some solution there. You know, take some solution there, because if that's my primary purpose is to help another drug addict, then where can I be more beneficial than somewhere like that, man? These guys are struggling, you know. So that's kind of what happened, you know, and I raised this baby and a lot of stuff happened along the way. You know, I was working as a recovery coach and my back was kind of against the wall. I wasn't making the money that I needed to make. And I'd worked with somebody that did these floors, decorative concrete floors, for a couple weeks, and I was like, if they can do that, I can do this, which was crazy, but I did, you know, and I was a good enough talker, man, and I started, you know, I'd go, and I had a guy that built me a website, and he ranked me a website, and I didn't know what I was doing, and I just learned, you know, I just kind of put God first in it, and there was some fear there, because that whole thing cost me quite a bit of money every month, and here I was working $12 an hour, and there was a point to where it was like I had to step out on faith and quit this job, which was not very much money, but it was a guaranteed paycheck. You know, it was just guaranteed, you know, so it's like I'm going to step out on faith, and I'd make a really good chunk of money on one that I would do, but when's the next one going to come? You know, so there was that whole fear thing of trusting God, you know. And I kind of just had to do that, and I've learned that even though I still wake up a lot of days and my head takes me to a different place, but my experience shows that when I'm staying close to God and performing His work well, everything works out. You know, even though my mind tells me, you know, hey, shit ain't going to work out. You know, I'm worried about money or worried about this, but it always works, man. If I'm doing the next right thing, shit just always works, you know. And it did. You know, I stepped out on faith and I started that company. And I guess it's probably been 5 years now, maybe. And I'm slammed, man. You know, I'm not even, you know, I've recently kind of, you know, I've had other friends are like, step back, let your guys do it, you know. And I've kind of stepped back from it now. I'm not even really doing much of the work, you know. I'm standing back. I got a good crew of guys that practice integrity, finally, which has been difficult. And I've just kind of stepped back, and it's just going, you know. And I've got this amazing life, man, you know. And, I got married, you know, made some mistakes along the way, you know, but I got married, and it's a blended family. You know, she had two beautiful kids, and I had Jude, my son, my he's five now, and she had two, and then we had a baby like 9 months ago, and so I got a whole army of them, you know, yeah, a gang of them, man. And I'll tell you, it talks about there, you know, that we're and I'm paraphrasing somewhere it says, and maybe it's, I don't know, somewhere in some of the literature, it says something about a demonstration of the principles, best whatever, in your home and your prospective employment or something, you know. And that was one of the things that was hammered into me, man. It was hammered into me early on in sobriety with that third step. And it's not technically the principle behind the third step, but it was integrity, 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 you know, doing the right thing, you know. And there's been some uncomfortable right things to do, man. I get on some of these jobs, something doesn't go right, and I'm wind up having to go in and tear this whole thing out, and it's going to cost me thousands of dollars out of my pocket, you know. And I'm just like, fuck, you know. And I've just done it, you know. I do it, you know. When you're doing the next right thing like that, you know, it's amazing what happens. It's almost like it's magic, you know. And you do some shit like that, and then the next day the phone just blows up, and you got so much work you don't know what to do with all of it, you know. So it's been super cool, man. And you know, life is just it's just been amazing, you know. I've kind of, one of the things that I've learned, you know, early on, I really kind of, I screwed this thing up. I didn't screw it up. I stayed sober. But I, you know, I did this meeting, carry this message, which was an A meeting at part of Benchmark, Mark Houston's, and they were real rigid, you know, AA, you know, and like this, and it kind of messed it up for me a little bit, because I was like, damn, I'm not doing that, you know, I'm not doing it like that, you know, I'm doing it wrong, you know, I'm not doing it right, you know, and I've just learned that, you know, just to keep it simple. You know, that's what I learned from some of the old timers. Keep it simple. You know, and so I really just do. You know, I don't do a lot. I got a couple sponsees that I talk to. I talk to my sponsor probably once a week. You know, I get really busy. I make probably one meeting, sometimes two a week. I can tell you early on building that foundation, though, it was 7 days a week meetings, sponsor every day. You know, and it just looks a little bit different now. You know, and recovery. You know, it's given me a life that tries to take me away from recovery, you know, because I have this amazing life today. You know, I've been able to, I've gotten married, I've got beautiful children, I've got an amazing career. You know, I was able to buy a home, I'm driving new vehicles, and all of that is, and none of that stuff really matters to me today, really. I really don't even really, it's nice, you know, because I remember my sponsor telling me that, you know, like, dude, he'd tell me, you know, just trust God, you know, everything, you're going to have this life beyond your wildest dreams. And I remember going, that's easy for you to say, man. You're driving a Jaguar and you're in your condo and I'm at the NA24 wishing I had a cigarette, you know? I'm like, you know? And, but it did, man. I mean, I'm a several time felon, you know? How the fuck? And he's like, you may just wind up being the president of Ford Motor Car. And I was like, right, you know? And so now I catch myself telling other people that same shit. Like, I'm telling you, man, if you do this work and you stay close to God and perform His work well, not only will He give you what you need, He's going to give you a life beyond your wildest dreams, you know, and that's been my experience with it. And so, you know, by no means do I do this thing perfectly, you know, but I'll tell you one thing that I have done is I've stayed somewhat consistent, you know, my prayer in the morning, some meditation and really just try to live it and practice some integrity, you know, and, yeah, I guess that's really about it, man. It's a really fucking good day to be sober, man, and be clean, man. Fucking A, man. God, it's good. So thank you, guys. Appreciate it.